with music and creating, anyone can do it. And that's beautiful. Advice I would give is just constantly create, constantly make, constantly finish something and move on to the next thing. Call it done and move on to the next thing and keep momentum going, keep outputting, keep creating. Don't get hung up on stuff that we get hung up on. Just don't let those things hang you up.
What's up, everybody? Welcome back to the Austin Meyer Podcast, where I interview amazing storytellers in all sorts of genres about their creative process and how they craft stories. Today on the show, my guest is someone who you just heard in the intro to the podcast, and not just the quote, but also the music that was playing behind it. My guest is composer PB, or Paul Bessenbacher, head of the band Opus Orange, which has been one of my favorite bands since I discovered their music in 2011. PB is an esteemed composer for film and TV, whose work has appeared in feature films, TV shows like Broad City, Younger, Grey's Anatomy, and The Detour, and national ads for Apple, Google, Samsung, and Adobe. On the songwriter side, he's collaborated with some world-class artists, including Tim Booth, Lauren Hillman, Emmy Reynolds, and Joe Gill. PB has also composed music for short and feature-length documentaries, which I was particularly interested in as a documentarian myself. Probably the moment I started to really pay attention to the band was when they did the soundtrack for a feature documentary called Mile, Mile and a Half, which is a film about a group of artists hiking the 219-mile John Muir Trail. And they did this over 25 days. And as part of that project, being the composer for the film, PB backpacked part of the trail with those artists, composing music on a little travel ukulele as he went. As I mentioned, I first came across PB's music in 2011 when I used a song from Opus Orange that fit perfectly into a little fun video I was making about a backpacking trip I was going on with friends. And since then, his music has appeared in countless of my projects, from a feature story on hydroelectric dam development in Southeast Asia that I did for Slate, to a short documentary from Zambia that I did for National Geographic, and a bunch of others. And I think I am attracted to this music because it's subtle, yet really communicates emotion. In this conversation, PB and I talk about the musical and life lessons he learned from studying classical piano at a conservatory, why he doesn't consider himself a, quote, creator, and the differences between writing albums and composing for film. Without further ado, I hope you enjoy my conversation with Opus Orange's Paul Bessenbacher. All right, let's jump into it.
Cool.
PB, thank you so much for joining the Austin Meyer Podcast. I'm very excited to have you on the show, finally.
I'm very honored to be a part of your show, Austin. Thanks.
Yeah. So for all the listeners out there, if you've listened to the Austin Meyer Podcast before, you have heard PB, you have heard his band Opus Orange, because it kicks off the podcast every single week. And I've been listening to PB's music for, I think I tracked it actually, PB, this today. I was going back to see like the first video that I like dropped on YouTube with one of your songs. And it was like back in 2011.
Nice.
On a backpacking trip that I went on when I first found your music. So the last couple days I've been going on my trail runs and kind of listening back through the years of Opus Orange.
Nice.
On Spotify.
I'm honored to be part of your process.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm curious whether you go back occasionally and listen to those old school tracks of yours.
It's very rare. The ones when I'm making it, I'm listening to it constantly. In the process, I'm immersed in it. Once it's out, I rarely go visit it again. Mm-hmm. I think it's a common truth. That the exceptions are things, and the Mile, Mile and a Half soundtrack in particular. That is one that like I have revisited it and been like, it's surprising the vibe, some of the vibes and stuff that came out of that, because it was highly collaborative. Bernard Chadwick co-wrote and co-produced it with me, and so because it was collaborative and it wasn't just coming from me, the things that came out of it are like, oh, that's new and that's unique. And because it also came out of the film, there's that collaborative process of the picture and the experience affecting the music. And because of that, all of these things, the dynamics that are influencing this, you know, this stereo audio file, all of those things, when I personally revisit it, it's often still surprising and refreshing.
Very cool. And so if you do you, when you play like live performances, do people ever request, or do you have like hits that people want you to play from the past that you bring out? What does that feel like?
I don't know if we're quite that in demand at this point, but You know that there are some people that you know, they have their favorites and they let me know and we try to hit them when they're at the show.
There you go. What were some of your musical influences when you were growing up? And in particular, I'm curious about like bands that were special to you when you were a little kid, or your family, or just kind of have a special place in your memory.
Yeah, there are the kind of like folk pop stuff growing up in my household, like Donovan and Carole King. That kind of folk 70s scene had a big influence on me. And when I started digging into music, as far as like listening to it for myself, I was fortunate to have an awesome older brother who was way hip and into the cool stuff, and so I remember early on there were bands like early U2. This is, you know, like around the album Boy in October, that kind of stuff. And that early U2 is way before, you know, they were like a little punkish, and like it was a small punk scene. The Dead Milkmen, like the punk scene for, my brother was a skater, so he was super cool. He still is super cool.
Shout out.
Yeah. And then it got into, as I got older, The Cure was a big influence for me. The Cure, Depeche Mode, The Smiths, those are very formative. And also, again, stemming from my brother, as he got older, and I was always like a few steps, because he was 3.5 years older, I was always a few steps ahead of, like my brother was listening to cooler stuff than kids my age were listening to.
Right, right. What was the first musical instrument you played?
Piano was it. When I was 7, my dad bought my mom a piano because he thought it was romantic. And this was on Valentine's Day. He thought it was romantic. So he's like, I'm going to get her a piano. And then they were not musically inclined, although my dad could sing. They didn't have a musical background. With the piano in the house, they put my brother and myself to piano lessons. Hmm. And then by then I started 7. 8. My brother was what, 10 or 11 or so. And that's how music started for me.
Mm. Do you remember having an immediate connection to music, or did it take a while for that to kind of percolate?
I think I did have an immediate connection. My piano teacher, Dorothy Kilgus, was formative in cultivating a sense of creativity within me. And this was, I think she saw it, because I'd go to piano lessons, and this was when I was 7 or 8, I'd go in and I wouldn't really be like observing what's on the page or trying to learn it. I'd be like tinkering and making noise on the piano while she's trying to teach me, which was probably frustrating for her as a teacher, because I wasn't listening. I was like just kind of like fiddling around on the piano. And she started a annual composition sort of contest. It wasn't a contest with like winners and losers, but it was like an incentive for her students who had a bent towards composition to compose music. So when I was 8, I wrote my first composition for solo piano in the, you know, in the key of C, because that's where your hands are meant to go. And I wrote it out on staff paper. And every year, again, since starting piano and being her student up through the end of high school, I wrote a piece, you know, at the very least. So from 8 on.
Mm. What do you think about that piano teacher? Like, what characteristics or something she said, or in what way did she kind of cultivate an appreciation for music and that desire to like want to keep up with lessons and compose your own music? Like, how did she enable that?
I think she just saw that I was not just thinking about how to learn piano. I was interested in all sorts of different stuff. And whether it was, I remember being interested in jazz or whatever it was, she kind of like cultivate the interest. And that was, I mean, teachers often are notorious for, you know, getting it right and directing a path that is tried and true and it has worked for them. But Mrs. Kilgus was adapting to each student to find out what strengths they have and cultivating that. And for me, it was the creative and less of the rules.
Mm. Yeah.
And that was, I mean, I'm forever grateful for that. Not that there were not rules, of course, but she really just, it was wide open to try stuff out and learn what you want to learn. If you want to learn a weird jazz piece, learn a weird jazz piece. And if you want to learn, like, she would allow that flow of momentum.
Hmm. Very cool.
And I think that was a formative gift for me.
At what point did you feel like music is something that I want to pursue professionally?
I remember in junior high was when music took root. Probably from when I was 7 to junior high, I just kind of like kept doing music, but I loved it, but I didn't, in junior high, I recall it just like really taking root. And then going into high school, playing in the jazz bands and still learning classical from Mrs. Kilgus and starting to play electric bass in junior high and like starting to play rock and roll. And all of this just opened up into like, I love every aspect of music.
Yeah.
And then by the time when I was a junior, I switched high schools to go to a more intensely music high school.
Okay.
And where the jazz ensemble was like the top in the state.
And what state is that again?
California.
California. So, okay.
Yeah, this was in Sacramento. I went to Rio Americano High School.
Okay.
That was junior senior year. That's why I switched to. So again, like it was kind of a trajectory where I'm going to uproot my social system that I knew in high school, in the middle of high school, and go to a school that's a half hour, 40 minutes away because I want to pursue music more. And my folks were behind it, and I was able to do that somehow within the public school system. I'm not even sure how, but I did it. But it worked out, and I got to, you know, that was formative, those junior, senior year, playing with some of the best musicians. They were awesome and inspiring. And that's where I, more roots, the roots got deeper and stronger. And then came college. I went to college not to pursue a career, but I went to college to do classical piano performance.
Oh, interesting.
So a Bachelor of Music in Piano Performance. And I went not because I wanted to be a concert pianist, but because I wanted to learn the craft fully. I wanted to dive into classical piano performance. I know that's really limited, but I loved being I was always varied, but I, instead of a jack of all trades, I wanted to be a sort of a master of all trades. And so in with that same sentiment, I was like, I'm going to go to school for 4 years and learn classical piano the best I can. And again, not because I want to be a, not career minded, but because that's it, that's what I wanted to learn and perform it and get to the, you know, just know it as well as I can in those 4 years and dedicate time to that.
So then coming out of college, then what did you do?
That was where I, you know, found office work, you know, and that was classical piano degree doesn't get you jobs. That's when I started to learn, well, at the same time as doing temp work in Chicago for, it was, you know, I collated papers like a pro. I also made copies really well and got coffee for executives really well. Uh-huh. So while doing that to try and pay rent, I was learning and playing in tons of different bands. I played bass in a ska band. I played keyboard in a indie folk band, and whatever. I loved playing music. So I was doing that and also learning recording, which I think is that, you know, that shaped my trajectory, is learning how to record and recording with bands and learning about signal flow and learning about mic pre's and how to get it into, at that time we were recording on, like, if you didn't have the money, you were recording on ADATs. Well, I don't know if you remember those, but
okay.
Those are like VHS tapes that are digital. I don't even know what they are, but they were 8-track ADATs. Mm-hmm. I don't even know what that stands for. but also Pro Tools was starting, and I started hanging around a studio. It was called Maestromatic, with Mark Messing was the owner, and I started hanging around him and just like being present and watching what he does and learning what he's doing. And eventually, like, he was like, hey, you want to write this song for this thing? And I was like, yeah. And I just jumped in to the production side of music making. Mm. And I learned Pro Tools at that point, how to work signal flow and microphones and programming MIDI and sample instruments and all that stuff was after college.
Okay. Okay, cool.
Yeah.
I want to get back to the production side in a minute, but I'm curious, when you were, so you mentioned you studied classical piano.
Yeah.
4 years dedicated to the craft.
Yeah.
That's what you were interested in, not thinking about too much about a career post, like really studying the craft. And I wonder, like, what elements of, like, deeply studying the craft of classical piano, like, what lessons did you learn from that that might not only relate to the music you do now, but more just like to life in general? Like, what were some of the things that you came out of studying classical piano for 4 years? Like, what do you take away from that, even if maybe you weren't going to be a musician?
Yeah, I think I take away the hard work that needs to be done to do, well, to do anything creative. It's work, and it's hard, and it's dedicated. I'm not saying I was the best student, but it demands hard work. Mm-hmm. Getting through a classical piano degree, even if you try to slide through it, you can't, because it demands hard work. And that's something that, like, I think is very important as any creative trying to make a living in whatever field they're in, is that needs to be a big part of it.
Yeah. Hmm. When you were learning Pro Tools in this recording software, was that did that open up possibilities for you to actually make consistent money doing music? And I asked kind of from the perspective of, like, for me as like a documentary filmmaker, I can't always just do my own projects, or at least I'm finding right now it's challenging to get those funded. It's challenging to make those on spec and get them purchased by a publication or anyone like that. However, I've heard that, like, if you know like After Effects animation, like really well, like boom, you can take on those freelance gigs. Same thing goes for like the editing and the production side. So for me, I think I'm kind of like where you were back in the day, where it's just like, I want to master all these parts of the process so I can open up myself to the most opportunities that might come.
Right.
Does that resonate with you?
Yeah, it does. Knowing Pro Tools is a tool. It's not necessarily a key, I guess, into paying work. Maybe it is for some. Maybe that is the thing. I mean, like when I first moved to LA and like I couldn't find music composition work, which is hard. It's hard to land those and find them. Like you're saying, it's hard to get that momentum going.
Yeah.
And I like was mixing audio. You know, like I could do Pro Tools. But, you know, I'm putting my musician and composition and creative interest aside to do, I'm mixing production audio and sound effects and somebody else's music onto this thing that's going to air. You know, I was doing that because it's a skill. So knowing these tools can be a skill to get work. It's not necessarily what you want to be doing, but it is some, I mean, like we all need jobs to pay rent.
Yeah.
When you were
learning the production side or the recording side, the digital side of music, did the types of music you were listening to or the types of music you were composing change once you started to learn this new craft?
I think it did. Learning Pro Tools opened up it was a tool to open up the skill of what it means to have a good recording and recording chops and the tricks that happen in the studio and the fact that I can like do that take again and the fact that I can overdub a harmony or like these kind of tools that as a coming from the classical or performance background, the beauty of that background, is that there's intense risk. You have, once you're on stage and you've been practicing a piece for months and months and months, and you know it, when you're in the practice room, you can screw up a section and go back and do it again.
Right.
But when you're doing what you're supposed to be doing, which is performing on the stage, you have one shot to get it. And that element of risk is really special and invigorating. And I think it that's what makes live performance so exciting in general. Knowing Pro Tools and learning that like in the recording and sort of, I'll call it post-production world, you can get a take again. And so there's like a levity to that, a freedom in that. That element of risk in a one-shot live performance is less there. And there's a nice comfort in that and a safety. And there's a inspiration creatively. I mean, like I can do whatever I want. I could record me stomping around the room. I can,
yeah.
I mean, it's totally wide open creatively.
Yeah.
So it did change the process. It changed how I view recording. It changes how I even listen to things that I like. And even when I listen to music that I enjoy, if I hear production and I'm thinking about the production, I don't enjoy it. If I can listen to music and I am in it, absorbing it and immersing myself in it without thinking about, oh, what did they do to make that? But I just hear a song or a vibe or the intent. That's what I love.
Mm. That kind of got to something I was going to ask, which was about like, what qualities make a good recording? And it sounds like you're saying a good recording for you is kind of where you lose yourself in it. You're not so aware of the process of it being post-produced as you, as you're listening to it. I want to hear the story of like how, where did Opus Orange come from? When did you start this band or this project? What was that born out of? And how did you and others come together and create this band, which I love?
Well, thank you, Austin. It stemmed from, I remember when I first moved from Chicago to LA, and I was trying to find work as a composer. At the time, you make websites, you know, here's my website, and you send it to someone. Here, my website has my reel, has my about page. It has some music that you can listen to, whatever. So I made a website, and I called it opusorange.com. Mm-hmm. And that was where I could sort of have a resume of sorts.
Why did you call it Opus Orange?
Opus is, in the classical sense, means a collection of work.
Oh, okay.
You know, in the classical world, so you have Opus 15, number 7. That means it's the 15th work of a composer. Mm-hmm. And that's the 7th piece in that umbrella of work. And I still carry this with me. Like, each thing I do, I try to have an umbrella sound to it. Each release that I do has an umbrella sound or a methodology. So Opus stems from that, and it stems, I mean, as a music geek in college, I had a license plate that was Opus 66, which is super silly. But it was, for me, that's Chopin's Fantasy Impromptu for solo piano, which was a formative piece for me in high school, and it's still one of the things that are one of the pieces that's always under my fingers. So that's where Opus comes from, and then Orange comes from, I played in a great band, and I don't know if we were great. It was great for me. we were fun. But in college, and that was called Orange Was the Color of Her Dress, which is a terrible name for a band. Maybe not terrible. It's a little mouthful. But that stems from a Charles Mingus tune. So I took those two ideas and made a website, you know, to peddle my wares and try and get work composing music.
And when you first put out music as Opus Orange, what was that umbrella sound? Or did you have any sort of vision of like what you wanted this to be?
You know, I try not to have vision. And that seems almost antithetical to being an artist. But I love following things and letting things be and not sort of dictating terms. So the answer is no, I didn't have a vision with it. The first As Opus Orange release we did stemmed from buying a ukulele, and I was in the studio and I just kind of put, you know, flailed away at some ukulele and then started singing tunes over it and recording it, and very under thought. I just let things happen, and then that's the first little EP, I think it's self-titled, that mm-hmm. one stemmed from that. So like almost all those tunes have ukulele on them because I got a uke and I was like, I don't know how to play a uke. And then that's how that happened. So that first thing kind of has a sound that the others' releases don't necessarily.
Yeah, it's funny, like hearing you talk about growing up with piano and studying classical piano, and I think back to the first Opus Orange songs I heard. I would never have guessed that,
yeah,
until like some of your more recent work. And I mentioned to you over email beforehand, like I really started to pay close attention to Opus Orange when you did the mile and a half project, because when I first heard your EP, the one with all that ukulele, like it just struck me as the feeling that I got when I listened was one of being in the outdoors. Mm-hmm. And that's why in 2011, I think it was, the first time I used one of your songs in my video was my friends and I going to Lassen National Park and this like really bad video that I made while I was still learning to use the camera and stuff, and set to your songs. I think it was Crystal Clear and the one with Lauren Hillman.
Almost There.
Almost There. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so then like a couple years later, I think it was, I saw that there was this documentary coming out about people hiking the John Muir Trail, and Opus Orange was the soundtrack for it. I was like, oh, like they, yes, this totally makes sense to me. Can you share a little bit about what this project was, and was this one of your first times composing for like a feature film like that?
The Mile and a Half project stemmed from a hub of creative folks that have since became the closest of friends, and all different aspects of creative avenues, like Jen's a photographer and Durand is a sound designer and Rick's a director and Jason's also a director and shoots photos as well. And Bernie and I are musicians. And so it was pretty cool to be part of a group of all encompassing creators.
Yeah.
I've always been into the outdoors and into backpacking, and the project stemmed from like-minded people that also like backpacking. And we didn't know what this thing would be. What we knew is that we were going to go hiking and we're going to bring our gear. And for me, that didn't mean anything. For them, it meant batteries and drives and cameras and zoom lenses and tripods and dollies. And then as far as scoring, I had been scoring. I got a job in LA writing music mainly for advertising, which I love. I love the short, well, this is about storytelling. I love the short storytelling that happens in good advertising. So I was scoring to picture a lot, albeit not long form. And then Mile and a Half, when we got back, the filmmakers started to see how this could actually be a documentary. And then the soundtrack, I didn't do the full trail, John Muir Trail, with them. We joined them for the last 8 days or so. And Bernie and I collaborate. I mean, having gone through that experience, came back, and there were songs that were written on the trail. And I brought a ukulele, and Bernie brought a like a toy glockenspiel with like the key of C, and then we would bang on rocks and sticks and whatnot, whatever we could find. So we were creating on the trail every night. We sang a song at the top of the Mount Whitney, and that I wrote as I was hiking up to the top of Mount Whitney, and there, you know, no instrument in hand. It was just like going through my head. Yeah, so like some of it was on the trail, but when we came back into post-production mode for the film, that's when Bernard and I we found a really good groove together, creating the vibe of that. I mean, it stems from being in it and being on it and experiencing it. And we were, you know, to be able to then create music that's inspired by it experientially is I think it's immeasurable the amount of value that is. I mean, as a composer, I could get hired to do a documentary that I don't have any connection to experientially. That's great, but there was something like really special about being experientially in the documentary. I mean, on the trail with these people, right, and then coming back and doing post-production with these people and like having it really be immersive, resonant, and it was almost effortless. When you can find that sweet spot, it really is nice. And Bernard and I had that momentum, and it was really magical, and creative and inspired. And we had a lot of just upward momentum when we were creating it. A lot of it wasn't on that one. It wasn't like, here's a scene, score it, which a normal project might be. What we did is we created a whole bunch of pieces that then Rick and Jason, as they were editing the film, would use those pieces in scenes. And then we would like maybe nip and tuck to make it work better, or do edits, mm-hmm. or of the existing pieces. So we sort of made the palette, and then the palette was used in the film.
Very interesting. It's great to hear a little bit of the backstory on making that. I want to know about your creative process. You told me at the beginning that you get super immersed when you're writing songs. So what is the difference creatively, like in your creative process as you're composing music when you're doing it for scoring a film versus writing for an Opus Orange album? And if we want to look at a case study, maybe we can talk about you have an album coming out soon here in 2020. You've already dropped two songs, which listeners can check out on Spotify, Opus Orange. There are two songs that are released already from this are Tell It Like It Is and Add Up the Years. So when you're writing songs, we'll start with that. We'll start with, you know, songs on your latest album. Where does the process begin for you? Is there like a common starting point, or does every song kind of take shape differently?
Every song takes shape differently for me. Sometimes it starts with a guitar riff. Sometimes it starts with a melody. I really love being open to any aspect of the process and be open to the process showing itself to me rather than, I guess kind of goes back, rather than like sort of dictating what I want the vision to be. I let things find their momentum. I kind of liken it to carving something out of stone rather than creating something out of nothing. Like in a stone that's uncarved, the piece is in there, the song's in there already, it exists, and I just need to like find it. But I'm not creating it, I'm just discovering it. I love that part of putting myself aside to try and like, let's find what's under there.
Yeah,
let's find what's inside this stone and see if it has any shape. And so I think of myself more as a discoverer rather than a creator. So with songwriting, it's totally a different process every time. With this latest album, we recorded the band live, and it was a great band. There were seven or eight of us in the room at a time, and recording live, which is a rare luxury these days, recording that many people live in a room. And again, because there is so much post-production music being created, there's so much programming and quantizing and that kind of thing. It was really refreshing to just play music with people in a room and have it captured. And then the songs, the sort of lyrical content came a little bit after, which is kind of, you know, it's a process that I'm discovering. So the tunes are recorded and I had to chisel away to find what the song actually was and discover the lyrics and the melodies as I was then alone in my room, you know, trying to discover these lyrics and where my voice is and how the melodies are shaped. And
last week on the podcast, I had a guest named Seamus Hart, who works at the Stanford Design School. And one of the themes of that episode was about prototyping stories, making like very rough versions of stories in order to test them out, get some feedback. So like when you're creating these songs, or sorry, not creating, when you're discovering those songs, carving away, discovering those lyrics, tactically, like, are you recording like little riffs in Pro Tools and then just like humming over it on your mic? Like, are you like putting down things all the time and listening to them back, or how does that?
I'm putting them down all the time. So I'll have the Pro Tools sessions and I will sit in my studio alone and discover my voice and discover the lyrics and I'll then often bounce it out and like listen back for a couple days and change what I need to change or see what bugs or doesn't bug or see where it needs to go, see where a melody needs to go. But I am always putting it down in Pro Tools. I'm always like documenting that way. And partially because what if it's good when I'm screwing around, you know, like, yeah. I want to make sure that snapshot is captured.
Right.
And if it is, I have it. And a lot of my vocals, they're often like right then as I was discovering the lyrics. Mm. They're often like at that moment. It's a slightly back-asswards process that it is fun, and I'm okay with it.
And then how do you go from alone in your room jamming out on Pro Tools with the headphones to bringing that to life and with a band with like seven other people, and then take that to a stage where you got to have a live audience feeling and vibing with it? Like, how do you go from alone in your room to that?
That's a great question. And it's something that like I'm still discovering. I mean, we don't play that often live. I'm hoping to with the coming album, in the new year.
Mm-hmm.
Lately I've been playing just with, my great friend and drummer, James Neal. And we just the two of us will go and just like, hey, let's strip down everything in this song and see if we can find the energy that we need with just, I'm playing electric guitar, and singing, and he's playing drums. So like strip down to some bare minimum, how do we find the energy that we need? And, the live mentality is a different one. Like I was saying before, it's a different one than the recorded art. There are almost two different skill sets. Some people are great at playing live and not as great in the production recording thing, and some people are the opposite. So like it is two different sort of muscles to exercise. Playing with James has been sort of it's exercising for me. It's like I'm getting to know how to even perform vocally. It's also a skill. It's like an instrument. If you don't play it, you just need to play it often.
Yeah.
So like exercising it in that way, practicing in that way is how you got to do it in order to translate it to a live scenario. And yeah. And with one thing I love about Opus Orange as a collective is that when we do have a live gig, I'm surrounded by this, I'm in this pool of amazing musicians. We can figure out what is needed for said live gig. So like last month or so, we played this great club in Hollywood called Gold Diggers. The stage was small and we just had four of us, and that's like the max, you know, you can't fit any more on that stage. So like figuring out like who's playing what to make four people great. And always adapting. I'm always adapting like what the sound of Opus Orange is going to be based on sort of the venue or the environment. So being surrounded by such incredible musicians, it's like color palettes. It's like an artist palette.
Well, definitely a theme I'm hearing it is that like that sound that you're delivering is discovering is constantly adapting. Constantly adapting to the surroundings in which you're composing in, if it's like Mile and a Mile and a Half, where you're out on the John Muir Trail,
yep,
or adapting even the same song to whether it's being played alone in your room, if you're in the recording studio, if you're on stage, how big is that stage?
Yeah,
so that seems like a real strong theme. I'm wondering selfishly as a filmmaker for the creative work that you've done scoring films, what can a filmmaker like myself, how can I set up composers, which hopefully will be you one day, for success? What's like the interplay between visuals and audio to enhance a story? And how do I set someone like you up for success?
Yeah, the collaborative process with filmmakers like yourself and with visual creators, I think is one that needs to be sort of always cultivated. Sometimes what happens in the process is the filmmaker might have some temp music and they put it up there because they got to edit to something, and then the composer gets brought on to make it better and make it cohesive and make the thing work as a full project. Which back to Mile and a Half, one of the beauties of that process, one of the treasures, was that we created the sound from which the filmmakers could pull from while in the edit. And I think that's rare that is even an option.
Right.
But when it does happen, and when that can be really special. That being said, as a creator, it's great to also be inspired by what you guys do as filmmakers and by what you do as visual makers, which again, hats off to you guys, because it's beautiful stuff that you're doing.
Thank you.
And that is inspiring. So on the flip side of what I just said with Mile and a Half, that inspiration can be open, and it is inspiring when the palette is open. Sometimes when there's temp music, it's hard to find your own voice because the filmmaker likes that temp music.
They get tied to it.
Yeah, they get tied to it, and that's always a challenge when it comes to creating for picture. But I, as a composer, am there to help your story come to life. I am not there as a composer to tell my own story or have my own voice heard, which I love. I love playing the supportive role in making your project story have the resonance it needs sonically.
Yeah.
And stay out of the way and make those things felt and not heard. Even with movies, I love it when I'm not distracted by the music. I love it when I can just be immersed in the storytelling of the film and I don't know what the music's doing. Like, right. When I'm able to really just hear or just be immersed in the story, that's a special place to be.
So that's probably then what you try to do as a composer as well, is try to deliver that feeling, but subtly.
Yeah, it is a goal of mine personally. But that being said, I do serve the purpose of the project and telling the story that needs to be told. That's the sort of master I serve. It is important for me to put my ego, check it at the door before I walk in, and put that aside and really make this project the best thing it can be.
Gotcha.
And I enjoy that. I enjoy that. That's one of the perks of being a musician, I think, is like being able to have a little divide be removed. Like, I don't need to tell somebody what a song's about, because the song's about whatever they want it to be about.
Yeah.
Even if it's not for me, like, it doesn't matter. Almost like if I tell too much, then it might change the resonance. So I like that about being a musician.
What kind of impact do you want your music to have? When are you the most fulfilled by the way that your art is impacting somebody?
That's a good question. I guess I'm honored when anyone even hears it and resonates with it, like, and internalizes it. If the music can be heard and absorbed and reflect on them personally, that's special. And that's something, you know, I enjoy when I listen to music. That's what I treasure. It's almost like when someone adopts it in a way and owns it in a way. Again, we're not some big band or anything, but when somebody comes up to me and after a show and they're like, that song really got me through something, that, I mean, just means the world.
Love that. Before we wrap up with our last question, I want to make sure that people out there can follow you and Opus Orange and all the projects you are working on. So for those who are interested, where should we send them? Where can they find you?
We are on all of the social medias. Well, I don't know about all of, there's so many these days. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and it's just at Opus Orange. And I ideally listen to us rather than follow our silly posts, listen to the music on Spotify and Apple Music and Amazon or whatever outlet that you stream music on. Great. Check it out.
Check it out, people. And you'll be checking it out every week or every 2 weeks on the Austin Meyer podcast if you continue to listen, and on many of the videos that I put out on Instagram and all that sort.
Which I'm honored to be part of.
Oh, well, thank you so much. So let's wrap up the main show here, PB, by asking the question that we ask to every guest. So I end every show by asking what advice you have for people who want to become better storytellers. And I'll also open that up to advice that you have for people who want to be, to compose their own music.
Yeah, I would say that anyone can actually do it. One of the beauties of, and this goes back to one of the first things we talked about, but it could be hard work, and it could be a lot of time spent, and it could be investing time you don't even have into doing it. But it is hard. It can be hard work. But the cool thing is that anyone can do it, and that's beautiful about, well, about a lot of things, really. I mean, about anything that you want to do, you can do. With music and creating, advice I would give is just constantly create, constantly make, constantly finish something and move on to the next thing. And by finish, I don't necessarily mean finish obsessively and not finish because you have obsessive things to do, but like call it done and move on to the next thing and keep momentum going, keep outputting, keep creating. Don't get hung up on the stuff that we get hung up on. And don't overthink. That's a big one. Don't overthink and keep creating, keep putting out and get feedback. And some artists get really stuck in overthinking a mix or overthinking a performance, or that take could have been better. And like, not, I don't want to say who cares in a flippant way, but I just don't let those things hang you up.
Great advice. PB, thank you so much.
Thanks, Austin.
For joining the Austin Meyer podcast.
It's an honor.
That's it for episode 31 of the Austin Meyer podcast. Thank you so much to PB for joining the show and to you for listening. If you want to hear more from PB, he did stick around for a post show to talk about what it's like to live in LA as a musician. And we also jumped into some fun questions like his favorite place to go backpacking. To access the post show, head on over to patreon.com/austinmeyerfilms. For as little as $2 a month, you can get access to all the post shows with our guests, as well as additional episodes. Every penny goes towards helping keep the mics on around here. For more on storytelling, you can find me on the social medias at Austin Meyer Films, and I've also linked my monthly newsletter in the show notes, where I write longer form reflections and distill some of the best tips and resources from my previous month's filmmaking experience, exploration, and conversation I've had on this show. I'm wishing everyone a very happy new year. I hope you're spending time with friends and family. Thank you so much for continuing to listen to this wild experiment of a podcast. Your support means the world to me. And with that, I will see you on the next episode of the Austin Meyer podcast. Go out and tell some stories.